I'm talking to history professor Dr. Manfred Berg. We're having a parallel discussion about he's obviously from Germany and here on a lecture, and we invited him to come by our studios to talk about his new book, Popular Justice: A History of Lynching in America. And we were just talking about how it is for someone from Germany to come and watch what's going on in the news. And you mentioned about the birther debate and how ridiculous it is. And I was telling him, if journalists are the first drafters of history, you said to me that historians will have a lot of cleaning up to do.
And that's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And hopefully they'll have something to clean up with. But let me go back to and open up the lines, by the way, 1-866-801-8255. Is the reason that it was so difficult? Well, I know the first question I had, I do want to go back to that. You mentioned just prior to the break that sheriffs started to become more protective of folks who went through the justice system, and they protected these victims of lynching or potential lynchings from mobs. So why the change? I mean, if there wasn't any repercussion legally, what do you think, or what did you find out was a change of attitude?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that public opinion had slowly but steadily turned against lynching, and it was, particularly in the South, it was seen as an embarrassment that hurt the image and the prosperity of the region. There were also groups such as the NAACP, but I think even more importantly, a group of Southern white women known as the Association of Southern Women for the Prevention of Lynching, who specifically targeted those sheriffs and implored them to do their duty. So there was some kind of public pressure. I also think what we need to keep in mind, and these are trivial things, as technology advanced, mm-hmm. especially with the introduction of radio communication and the automobile, it became easier to, for example, to haul away prisoners for safekeeping to a different county or to a different city. But what we should also keep in mind is that often those prisoners who were saved by sheriffs, that they ended up dead anyhow, because the tacit understanding was that there would be a swift trial that would end mm-hmm. with a certain death sentence and a swift execution. So scholars, and I think rightly so, have spoken about legal lynchings, legal executions that for all practical purposes amounted to lynchings. They were bereft even of a modicum of due process. And I found really appalling stories of such legal lynchings in the literature. Well, there's a fairly well-known story of a black man accused of having raped a white woman in Kentucky, and he was brought into the courtroom, and 45 minutes later he was cut off from the gallows. I think that was something that does not have even a resemblance to a fair trial. My argument is that the death penalty also comes in as a substitute.
All right, maybe before we go there, I'll go back to this so-called organization or League of Southern Women, who, you know, came out protesting against lynching. I find that interesting in the sense that a lot of lynching, as you point out in your book, has to do with protecting white Southern womanhood. Does it not?
Correct.
And so here you have a group of women who are speaking out against these kinds of lynching.
That is what makes it really so important. The overriding ideological justification of lynching was lynching is a deterrence against rape, and black men are the so-called black beast. They rape white women whenever they get a chance. And this is why it was so important that Southern Christian women would stand up and say, hey, listen, we do not want that kind of chivalry. We should really not lionize this group. These were Southern ladies. They were all for segregation. They were against federal anti-lynching law. So they were all for states' rights, but of course they were supporting the death penalty. They thought that a rapist should be executed. But all the same, their argument was, we don't need this, the law must take its course. It is difficult, really, to gauge the impact of such groups, but I think they had an impact in slowly changing the public mood. And I think what we see, what's so interesting, what we see from the 1920s onward, well into the 1940s and early 50s, is that lynching goes underground. The type of spectacle lynchings that are fairly common in the late 19th and early 20th century,
where people would have picnics and the children, and they would sell body parts and that type of thing.
All that type of thing is no longer acceptable.
I see.
Is no longer acceptable. And I think that is also, that signals the kind of cultural change that goes on.
Let me do this. I will take questions, and I don't want to keep people waiting a lot. But I've got Dr. Muhammad Philadelphia. You had a question. Oh, I need to put the headphones on. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. It's like a 2 or 3 pronged question.
All right.
One question is, how is the professor's book different from a very popular exhibit that was called Without Sanctuary, which displayed the history of blacks and lynching across the country at different African-American museums in the last, 5 years or so?
All right, let's take each prong the question separately. Dr. Berg, go ahead.
Well, thank you for asking that question.
And then I'll get to the other two points.
Of course, I'm familiar with the Without Sanctuary exhibit. My book is the first history of lynching that covers the entire period from the colonial era to the aftermath of the Second World War, and it also looks at different groups of victims. Mr. Allen's exhibit largely focuses on the age when we have photography, which is basically from the late 19th century onward. Also, my book is obviously a narration. There's some illustrations in the book, but it is mostly a story that I'm telling.
All right, point two.
The second point is, we know that one of the issues that why blacks were lynched in American history is because of the accusation of rape against a white woman. My question is, in his research, did he run into the first case in history where someone was actually convicted of raping a black woman? Because we know in American history, in the 1600s, the 1700s, and most of the 1800s, rape was not, there's no one being convicted of raping a black woman. So the question I have, did he run into, when did that happen, the actual conviction of rape with respect to black women?
Frankly, I did not come across such a case, but obviously you're right. Whereas white womanhood, so-called white womanhood, was put on a pedestal, it was understood that black women, for all practical purposes, were fair game. So
right.
What we do find, however, and this is interesting, is that because the white criminal justice system in the South obviously did not punish the rape of black women by black men, we have cases of lynchings when black communities lynch black men for raping black women.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Mama.
Okay, I have one more question about
I've got 1 minute, they tell me, before the break, but go ahead quickly.
Okay, this is about the Did he talk about the whole history of the NAACP's attempt to get a federal lynching law?
That is that's coming up in the right after the break.
Okay, all right.
I'm going right to that. Yeah.
Okay.
So
all right,
you've given us a segue into the next break.
Thank you.
We'll continue here with Madison. My guest is Dr. Manfred Berg. The book Popular Justice, A History of Lynching in America. And we'll talk about this NAACP campaign to get an anti-lynching law and why it didn't succeed right after this. And we'll take your calls, 1-866-801-8255. As he said, the first book that really, and this is why I wanted to have you come in and spend an hour, because we know of the photographs, like you said, during the photographic era. But this, you took us back to colonial days and beyond World War II. And so it's a very comprehensive history of lynching in America, and it should be discussed, and we'll take more calls, 1-866-801-8255.